You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Fall semester is officially in full swing at LAUSD. It is momentous for educators and families who have been long marooned in the world of virtual learning. Last year really took a toll on teachers who were required to pivot to teaching over video, sometimes juggling in-person classes with students at home, many of them watching hard-won gains in learning disappear into black boxes on Zoom. Now, teachers and students, for the most part, are ecstatic about getting back into the classroom. Here's educator Candace Allen. She teaches at Larchmont Charter School in Hollywood, and she spoke to KQED's Saul Gonzalez.
I'm so excited.
Talk to me about
Zoom,
that.
No, Zoom teaching is not, it's just not effective. I need my kids engaged. I need the rapport, or I need to see their faces, or now just see their eyes and, you know, their body gestures and demeanor and all that good stuff.
But as parents and teachers applaud the return to the classroom, not everyone has gone back. According to a survey by nonprofit RAND Corporation in early 2020, one in four teachers was considering leaving the profession. And according to the California State Teachers Retirement System, CalSTRS, teacher retirements were up 26% in the second half of 2020 over the year before. KCRW's Danielle Chiraguayo has spent the last few months talking with former teachers, and she's with us right now. Hi, Danielle.
Hey, Steve.
So what are common concerns that you've been hearing from current and former educators?
There's exhaustion, there's burnout, bewilderment, and quite a bit of guilt. These are all young, early career educators, all the way up to story professionals who've been in the teaching game for decades. And these departures, Steve, for the record, are happening everywhere. For instance, leave of absences at Long Beach Unified have increased by 35%. And of course, early retirements, as you just mentioned, are also up. And overall, teachers are especially dissatisfied with their jobs and with their working conditions. I do want to make one thing clear, however. Some educators are absolutely embracing the new school year. And for the scope of this piece, I looked specifically for educators who were quitting or had at least considered it. And that includes Emma Gallagher. Up until this year, she was a science teacher over at Venice High School. She's just 24 years old and has spent the last 3 years teaching.
I was already really struggling in the classroom. I was finding myself being consumed by my job and having no capacity left for my friends. My mental health was deteriorating. I always say I'm 24, but I feel like I'm 34 after everything I've been through these past few years.
She says the beginning of the pandemic felt like a much-needed reprieve from the daily grind of in-person instruction.
The beginning of the pandemic was a break, was rest, where all I had to focus on was just getting lessons to my students and not worrying about behavior issues or fireworks blowing up in trash cans in the hallway and my own self, you know, falling apart in front of students.
But that quickly changed for Emma. The demands of teaching virtually started to pile up almost immediately. She, in some ways, had to learn how to teach all over again.
We're trying to take Zoom attendance and Schoology analytics attendance and messages. And, I mean, it was such unrealistic expectations on the teachers, on top of just trying to rewrite our entire curriculum. So it was, I would say it's a mess. Every day I felt like a bad teacher. Every day I felt like I was experiencing a lot of failures.
It sounded to me, Danielle, that she was under a lot of pressure. How did they cope as teachers?
Not very well, to be quite honest. I spoke with more than half a dozen educators who say they felt like they were saddled with all of these unrealistic expectations. That includes Samira, an East LA teacher whose full name we're not using because she's concerned about getting in trouble with her district. She tells me that she was on the verge of quitting just this last summer.
And I was feeling so like on my own, like I was being expected to do all of these things and not being paid for it, which feels very exploitative to me. And I think in order to be a good teacher, you can't be burnt out. But if you're not going to be burned out, then you also can't do it all. I don't know, as a teacher, you have to always be kind of navigating like what is the most important thing to do, because I can't do everything.
Samira also says she feels like the clock was ticking. When she first started, she was warned that many educators only make it about 3 years until burnout starts to set in.
Yeah, burnout. And, you know, teaching is inherently or certainly can be a thankless job, Danielle. I mean, did you get the sense that the pandemic pushed a lot of teachers over the edge?
Absolutely. For example, through the pandemic, Emma says she was having panic attacks and depressive episodes weekly, which ultimately led to her quitting. And she's still dealing with that guilt over making the choice to leave.
Of course there's guilt tied up in it. Of course there is. I mean, it's like, if I'm not my best in the classroom, there are 180 faces staring up at me. And I know their stories. I know what they're going through. I know how they need support. And if I can't provide that, I know exactly how it affects them. Saying goodbye to teaching was the hardest goodbye I've ever had to make.
But at the same time, Emma talks about how incredibly rewarding being an educator was for her.
My coworkers were my friends and my family because we went through shit together all the time. And your world becomes teaching. You know, you're invested in a community and you see these kids graduate and you see the little changes in their life. And there's like a high to that. It's really hard to find a profession that is that directly tangible in terms of your contributions to someone else's life. It's that keeps you going. And when you leave that, you know how you'll be missed and you know.
It was obviously a hard decision for Emma to leave her position. I'm curious, Danielle, what were some other reasons that caused these educators to leave their jobs?
Well, that switch over to virtual instruction was actually the straw that broke the camel's back for former English teacher Sheshu Foster. He's been teaching for over 3 decades, and recently over at the Francisco Bravo Medical Magnet High School.
It took me weeks and weeks to learn the ins and outs, the glitches of the system, and that it actually took me 2 or 3 times as much time to deliver a much weaker lesson, a much more watered down presentation for students who were not having as much fun as they did together in the classroom. It was not as interesting to sit in their room hour after hour on their own computer. And when push came to shove, that pushed me out.
Retirement was the last thing on Sesshu's mind pre-pandemic. And he says if it wasn't for COVID, he probably would have stuck around for a few more years. And Steve, talking about the use of technology in the classroom, all the educators I spoke to felt like the pandemic would transform how they work with students, but found themselves disappointed time after time. Here's Emma again.
I was so excited for this to be a revival of education. I was so excited for, you know, online and, you know, hybrid pedagogy to find its way into the classroom and all this innovation, technologies. And I just saw things going back to same old status quo.
Sumira, the teacher from East LA, says she hoped the pandemic would prompt smaller class sizes and push at the LAUSD to fully embrace tech. Instead, she's seen a lack of in-classroom resources and has even been assigned bigger class sizes.
It was just at that moment that I got very overwhelmed, like emotionally, and realizing like, okay, the pandemic is still happening. Picturing that in my mind, like, okay, if I could barely fit 35 kids in my classroom, how am I going to fit 42? And then also, like, we're all going to be breathing the same air. I guess at that moment, like, I felt really betrayed, and my hopes were crushed because the thing, like, maybe my top priority for what I wanted to change after the pandemic, I realized, like, that's not going to happen. Like, things are just going back to normal.
So, Danielle, what are the long-term effects of this mass teacher exodus?
Depending on who you ask, you'll get a different answer. But there's one major takeaway. At the end of the day, the cost of teacher turnover is not only going to affect the quality of education our students are getting, but it's also going to hit us where it hurts most, our wallets. The National Commission of Teaching and America's Future estimates that teacher turnover could cost us more than $7 billion per year. And Steve, as we're wrapping up, I just want to mention one thing. After all these hours and hours of interviews with current and now former educators, there's been this sort of invisible string connecting all of these stories. The problems that folks have endured are not new to the pandemic. A lot of them are issues that have long impacted educators, being underpaid and overworked and feeling disrespected. Here's Emma one last time.
All the good teachers are either workaholics and they sacrifice. They have strained marriages, strained relationships with their kids. A lot of great teachers, their whole life is teaching. You know, everyone loves teachers until they're inconvenient. You know, like, oh, we love teachers. Like, thank you so much. Like, we'll support you in the strike. And then they're like, people are like, I'm sick of my kids. Like, you need to go back to work. Y'all are being lazy. You know, it's like, it's one of those. So I just really want people to understand the inner workings of the profession on just like the deep emotional level, the things that they don't see.
The things that they don't see, you know, teachers do a lot, and we're going to see the effects, obviously, of this pandemic on education going forward. KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo reporting for us. Danielle, thank you.
Thank you so much, Steve.
School days were the happiest days. Now they seem so far away. I remember, and I'll always treasure school days were the happiest days of your life. Now I wish I had strength, and I'd go back if I could only find a way. Oh, school days.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. With California staring at the possibility of even more treacherous wildfires in coming weeks, there's a renewed focus on the heroes who battle those blazes, and all blazes, from giant swaths of forests and dry brush to a building maybe that's burning because of an electrical short or an arsonist. Well, one thing you'll notice about firefighters in the city of LA is that the vast majority of them are men. Women make up only about 3.5% of the LAFD force. 3.5%. One former female firefighter even called her co-workers, quote, misogynistic, and the leadership, quote, cruel. Battalion Chief Chris Larson is an LA City firefighter. She's also president of the LA Women in Fire Service, which is a professional organization looking to support the women who make up the force and even grow the numbers, too. Battalion Chief, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be speaking to you today. Thank you.
Well, it's an honor for us as well. You guys do wonderful work, and I know it's hard and grueling. The LA Times came out with an investigation last month surrounding a former colleague of yours, Katie Becker. She left the LA Fire Department in 2019 after experiencing sexism in a department that she described as, quote, littered with cruel leadership and misogynistic coworkers. Would you say that that's accurate or agree with that comment?
Well, first off, I'd like to say, you know, Katie Becker is a strong individual for coming forward and speaking to these issues. The department has been historically plagued by issues regarding race and gender within the department. It seems like it's gotten a little bit worse over the years. And as the females go, there's just not enough of us to have a statistical impact on the department. So it's very easy for the men to kind of belittle because if there's not another woman at your station, who's going to stick up for you? So right now we are seeing issues with African-Americans and females in the fire service having disparaging treatment, and it's getting bad.
And the thing about firefighters is that oftentimes they're on shifts where, you know, everybody has to live together under one roof at a firehouse waiting for that call. Is there, because you mentioned, you know, at the firehouse, sometimes you're the only one there. Is there a gender dynamic that makes it more difficult for women in a situation like that? I mean, especially when men outnumber women by a whole lot.
It does, but it doesn't have to. LA County Fire Department has the same issue as they don't have a whole lot of women within their department. But the fact of the matter is the leadership in that fire station, that fire officer, plays a big role in the culture within that fire station. And so if that officer is welcoming, treating everybody with courtesy and respect and not allowing others to berate or belittle somebody that is ethnically or gender diverse from the rest of the crew, then you have a really wonderful working environment. And places where there is that belittling culture, if you are a minority, you're probably going to be the target of some cruel and horrible, you know, things. But that being said, there are some absolutely wonderful and amazing people that work within this organization. The sad thing is, a few bad apples are ruining it for everybody else. So, unfortunately, they're not being held to a standard that's going to, you know, get them in trouble. Those punishments are being washed down or not even given out.
Has that been happening to you? I mean, some of these stories that you're hearing, are they the same in your case as well?
You know, they happen, and I would consider what I've gone through mild. I would consider them microaggressions, but none the same. They're hurtful. Most recently, when I was taking my battalion chief's exam, I had one of the other test takers, male, question why I was there. Why are you taking this exam? You just crossed your bugles, which is a reference to the fact that I had newly promoted to the rank of Captain 2, but I had been a Captain 1 for about 7.5 years. So total time in rank was just under 10 years as an officer, which more than met the qualifications. And at that particular point, I came on the job with a bachelor's degree, and I was about halfway through completing my master's degree. So that kind of showed how little he knew about me.
You had every right to be there.
I had every right to be there. And I don't know if he made the same comment to the other female that was taking the exam, but in an open forum, he felt just fine making that comment. And, you know, this is 2016. We're not talking, you know, years and years ago. You know, this is like 5 years ago. So it continues, and it continues regardless of rank, because any woman that promotes, they're saying, well, how did she get there? Is she qualified to do this? Where has she worked? What skill set does she have? There's always a questioning.
Do you think that's part of the reason that kind of misogyny, or even just, you know, rumors or anticipation of misogyny is what keeps women off the force, that they're not interested in doing this? Because who wants that kind of hassle?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, you've got to want to be a firefighter. And it's a lot of hard work, and we're seeing that departments across the country are struggling to find firefighters. I just read something from South Carolina. I mean, it is a nationwide problem where we're having a shortage of firefighters. And obviously in California, we have a huge need for firefighters, whether you're in a big urban department or whether you work in the wildland, there is a huge need for firefighters. But you're going to have to work hard, and you're going to have to make some sacrifices. And not everybody is willing to do that. And it's harder, I think, for women, because we've never been socialized to think we could be a firefighter. From a very young age, women are not socialized to think that this is a viable career for them. This is a great career. It affords you a lot of stuff. The schedule can be tailored to have a family, to have vacations, opportunities, especially in a large organization like the LAFD. There's a whole lot of places that you can promote and work without, and that you're not in the fire station. We have arson investigations, we have scuba divers, we have fire inspectors, we have helicopter pilots, we have boat pilots. I mean, there's a whole vast array of other options once you get your foot in the front door. So really, it's about messaging that this is a great career, but it's something that you've got to want to do. And if you're not socialized to think this is something you could do, it's probably not going to be even in your radar.
But being on the front lines and fighting those fires, I mean, obviously, it takes physical endurance, right? Physical strength. And I mean, what do you say to folks who tell you women and men are built differently, or maybe men are more able to do the most physical part, you know, like carry somebody out of a building, which, by the way, I could never do, right? That's tough. And men and women are built differently, are they not?
We are absolutely built differently. But again, we talk about firefighting being the ultimate team sport. Unless somebody is down and it's just the two of us, we're not doing stuff alone. We're always working in pairs. We're always working in groups. That I think it's a misnomer that I'm going to pick somebody up and put them on my back. If I did that in a fire, I'd probably burn them worse than they're hurt. There are just tricks and techniques that we use that can change that. And you're right, everybody is built differently. I am stronger than the average female, but I've worked in the drill tower and I saw women who had hearts of gold that are not as big as me still succeed.
The advocacy group that you lead says that a study of workplace culture has been delayed for more than 3 years. Why the delay?
It has started now. We've had one meeting. We'll have another meeting in a couple weeks. First, it was a funding issue. It was funded. Then the money was swept. I'm not sure why. The fire chief had to farm it out to a bunch of different organizations to try to fund it. Mayor's Innovation Team and some other, the Fire Foundation, LA Fire Foundation. And it was finally funded 3 years later. So I'm cautiously optimistic that we're going to have some results in the not too distant future. But I don't think that precludes getting information out there now about the culture of the organization from the fire chief, messaging that we need to be treating each other with respect that everybody deserves.
Well, that leads into the next question then, with the delay and trying to find the, you know, the funding for a study like this and all of that. I mean, do you think that management has your back? I mean, are they doing enough to make sure that there is the recruitment out there, that women feel like, you know, they are covered, that you know, that they don't have to deal with these problems?
Well, I think from a recruitment aspect, we're doing as much as we can to recruit as many qualified candidates as we can get. I think what is lacking is the messaging from the top. And I'm hoping that at some point the fire chief's going to come out with a statement that says, you know, hey, reinforce this zero tolerance for hazing, harassment, and discrimination, and put people on notice that behavior won't be tolerated. Sadly, I just haven't seen that in a while.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, you don't sound completely confident in management and leadership, yet you stay, yet you want to continue with LAFD.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been here for about 30 years, and, you know, it's a great place. There, like I said, there are some wonderful people within this organization. I think right now, the department has been in a managed by crisis situation with staffing levels and COVID. And so it seems like whatever the new shiny thing is what we're going to focus on, and not some of the core issues that we have as an organization. You know, it's hard to put a mirror up to yourself and be honest and look and see your faults. But I'm hoping that this organizational study is going to give us that. It's going to give us some information that we may not like, but it's going to give us a roadmap for where we need to go in the future to deal with the issues we have culturally within the department.
And a roadmap for recruitment as well, to get more female firefighters on the force. And to that end, what kind of training programs, I mean, professional support groups besides your own, you know, are available for women who want to become firefighters? Is there active recruitment, say, at college campuses or other places?
Absolutely. We're reaching out everywhere we can to find qualified candidates, especially women, and we know that there is a nexus between a lot of the women on the job and their prior activities with sports. So we are actively, minus COVID, trying to recruit on those college campuses, and we've been pretty successful doing that. We offer free interview prep. We have a robust website. We have a CAP training program that all of our candidates that are in the process are invited to. And the LAFD is trying to get the best, and we're trying to give them the tools to be successful. But it's like many organizations now, we struggle to get people to take us up on these free programs. So it costs the department money to offer the programs to pay the staff. But again, if the LAFD is offering a program, it's designed for that candidate's success.
I want to thank you for coming on to talk to us about this. So many issues. L.A. City Firefighter and Battalion Chief Chris Larson. By the way, the first female African-American captain promoted to Battalion Chief over at L.A. Fire. So congratulations on that feat.
Thank
and
you.
Also president of the L.A. Women in Fire Service. Thank you for your time. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much for hosting me. Appreciate it.
That's all the time we have for today. Well, we talked about teachers at K-12 schools earlier, but what about students starting or going back to college? In the Inland Empire, there are different protocols for getting on campus. Masks inside, even mandatory vaccinations for students at UC campuses. Handling higher education in the second year of a pandemic tomorrow on GLA. All of our stories, by the way, online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Subscribe to the podcast there. Tell us how you're doing. Tell us how we're doing. kcrw.com www.kcrw.org/greaterLA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Juliana Mayo, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Sue Margulies, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Amy Ta, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordahl were all instrumental on the show this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for being with us tonight. Have yourself a great night.